Welcome to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast for the week ending April 23rd. This is podcast number 84. I'm Joe Elia. For links to earlier offerings, go to podcasts.jwatch.org. And for a detailed look at what's new in clinical medicine, just aim your browser at jwatch.org. This time, we talk with Richard Wenzel on the one-year anniversary of the emergence of 2009 H1N1 influenza. First, here's a summary of the week's top clinical news. There's now a boxed warning on PTU, propyl thiouracil, about the hyperthyroidism drug's ability to cause severe liver injury. The FDA says PTU should be only used in people who cannot tolerate methimazole or other treatments, and in women in the first trimester of pregnancy. Next, a pilot study in the Annals of Internal Medicine this week points to a high rate of false positives among those undergoing annual screening for lung cancer. Among some 3,200 current or recent smokers undergoing two rounds of CT or radiographic screening a year apart, the false positive rate among those having CT screening was over 30%. The false positive rate was about 15% in the radiography group. Roughly 5% unnecessarily went invasive procedures to rule out cancer, and 2% had major surgical procedures that weren't needed, it turned out. The authors advise that patients requesting CT scanning be advised of these risks. Finally, it seems that hospitalizations for acute myocardial infarctions are declining, according to a circulation study. In the interval between 2002 and 2007, the rate among fee-for-service Medicare recipients showed a 23% decline. That's the news for this week. Now on to our interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. Earlier this week, at the one-year anniversary of the 2009 H1N1 flu outbreak, the New York Times carried an op-ed piece by a respected physician and teacher, Dr. Richard P. Wenzel. This winter, many clinicians spent hours addressing patients' questions whose answers were often unknown, unclear, or had shifted from the previous week. Dr. Wenzel's essay suggested that with the pandemic apparently on the wane, it would be good to chat a bit about what we've learned and how we might do better next time. Dr. Wenzel is professor and former chair of the Department of Internal Medicine at the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond, and he's also editor-at-large for the New England Journal of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Wenzel.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, it's hard to believe, but it's only been a year. It seems perhaps much longer than that since this thing happened.
It really is just a year, although a long year.
Quite. So, for you, I'd like to ask, what were the most difficult aspects of the pandemic? Was it the uncertainty that we all felt about what to do, or was it those the constant questions from patients that you couldn't really answer definitively?
I think with any new epidemic or pandemic, there was always uncertainty, and trying to predict the trajectory of this virus was certainly high on the list. There were a lot of other issues, I think. The confusion created by World Health Organization calling this a pandemic sixth level, when people really didn't understand either what pandemic meant or what level six meant compared to what we've seen before. And then there were also clinical challenges, because we learned very early that a third of the patients with documented H1N1 admitted to hospitals had no fever on admission. And in fact, in some countries in South America, where I visited, half of documented outpatients with H1N1 had no fever. So there were challenges to diagnose this, as well as challenges for infection control.
You mentioned in your essay Mexico's openness about the extent of the illness there, and the fact that the illness, the pandemic, cost it about 1% of its GDP. Do you think that the U.S. dodged the bullet because of Mexico's openness? Did that better prepare us, do you think?
I think it helped a great deal, and whether it was certainly a contributory factor. Remember that Mexico made a decision in about 10 days from the time they identified what appeared to be a new virus and a new syndrome affecting young people. And their announcement publicly to the world that they really had a new epidemic. Contrast that with the months and months that went by before China made a similar declaration after SARS in 2003. And I think to emphasize, again, the transparency, Mexico made the decision knowing the unfavorable economic consequences that would follow.
You said that that sort of openness might be rewarded somehow. Do you have any ideas about how one could do that?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the devastating cost of SARS related to the delay and the cost of any pandemic globally, it seems to me that a body like World Bank might consider holding some money in reserve to really encourage and reward, in fact, countries that have the kind of transparency that we saw with Mexico, because I think there are the economic incentives to hold back and maybe deny that something is going on are great enough that we need to overcome that.
In this country, there were innumerable briefings from the Centers for Disease Control. Did you find those helpful?
Many of them were helpful, but there were several that I thought were incorrect and unhelpful. For example, in my view, the health officials erred in their recommendation to send children and adults back to school or work or 24 hours after their fever disappeared. And the first part is that, remember, a lot of people don't have fever at all. And second, even if you had fever, 24 hours later, you're still contagious. Young children, for example, are contagious for up to 3 weeks, as are immune-suppressed people, and adults for 5 to 7 days after the onset of influenza. So this recommendation flies in the face of what we know about the biology, epidemiology of influenza. And so what I think public health authorities have to do is be more transparent, if you will, about the recommendations that try to find a compromise between what's good infection control and what we really know conflict in terms of trying to maintain social activities and businesses. And so what I would suggest that we really have to know the lexicon of uncertainty a little more precisely and be transparent about the conflicts that normally arise in making recommendations.
If I could paraphrase, I guess the public health officials have to be more willing to say, we don't know.
That's absolutely right. And I think people will find that refreshing. One of my views is that there's really current skepticism in general, at least in the United States, about large organizations and government in general. So that if there are any missteps, why the credibility of the next statement is actually in jeopardy.
As clinicians, and as a clinician yourself, what next year, I'm presuming here that the epidemic is over, but that's probably, it's quite possibly wrong. I mean, it's jumped up again in the southeast of the U.S. At least a month ago, it jumped back up again. Is it possible that this is maybe a continuing kind of pandemic?
Well, the history, first of all, is that anyone who tries to predict influenza does so at great peril. That's the first thing I'd say. And the second is that once new viruses emerge, they tend to hang around for a while. And the issue is whether the current 2009 H1N1 will have minor changes in its surface proteins, the hemagglutinin or the neuraminidase, and therefore lead to the need for newer, updated annual vaccines as this becomes perhaps a seasonal virus. We don't know the answer to that. I think we have to be prepared for that.
Yeah, so we don't know, but we do know that the antigens for the 2009 H1N1 will be in the seasonal vaccine for the coming year.
Correct.
And so at least we don't have to worry about whether to get how many shots we have to arrange to get for ourselves. And you've implied, we could be wrong about that. We could be wrong about a lot of things. So as a clinician, what do you think you'll try to do differently next year that you've learned from this year?
Well, I think we have to recognize the broad spectrum of influenza, from asymptomatic illness up to severe respiratory distress requiring intensive care therapy. I think we have to try to resolve the issues of how to protect healthcare workers in hospitals optimally, and specifically see if we can get new information on whether the N95 mask versus the standard surgical mask offers advantages. There's a lot we don't know about treating severe influenza. For example, do steroids help? Do they hurt? The retrospective data now look as though early therapy with neuraminidase inhibitors, such as oseltamivir, seem to prevent severe disease and even death. Even though we don't have prospective data, all the retrospective studies look like that. We still don't know whether ECMO really helped people or just extended the cost of severe disease.
ECMO, I'm sorry.
Extracorporeal membrane oxygenation for people whose lungs are so severely damaged that they can't oxygenate the blood. And a number of institutions tried ECMO. And again, highly technical, highly expensive approach, essentially bypass. And we don't know whether that worked either. So hopefully we can learn while the epidemic or seasonal virus is going on, more information. You don't have much warning when the flu hits, and I think we have to be prepared to make the most out of it in terms of trying to learn something.
Well, Dr. Wentzel, I want to thank you for your advice and for your time with us today.
Great pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week. You can reach Clinical Conversations at 1-617-440-4374. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano, and I'm Joe Ilya. Join us next time. Thanks for listening.